Today is Monday, March 7th, 2011, and I'm Gordon Lee.
I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local...
Good evening. It's 5:12 p.m. and time for your full hour of independent news.
Today, we will be talking to Amnesty International UBC regarding their upcoming conference, and we'll also be bringing you coverage of some criticisms of BC parks.
All this plus... a UArts report and your weekly weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with
Free Speech Radio.
Protests erupted this weekend in Gaza over Israel's closure of the territory's primary commercial border crossing. Palestinian truck drivers say the one remaining commercial crossing does not have the capacity to handle their economic needs. FSRN's Rami Almagari has more.
With the ordered closure of the Karni crossing this weekend, Israel has now sealed off all but one of Gaza's four commercial border crossings. The Karni crossing, called Montar by Palestinians, had been a major economic hub since the mid-1990s. Now only the Kerem Shalom crossing remains open, and commercial sources in Gaza say it is too small to handle large numbers of shipments. Dr. Maher Al-Tabba is a spokesperson for the Gaza Chamber of Commerce.
Unfortunately, the complete closure of Montar will badly affect the Gaza economy. It further tightens the siege of Gaza. The Kerem Shalom crossing is about 50 kilometers away from downtown Gaza City, and this will increase the cost of shipments. Residents will likely pay the price.
The Kerem Shalom crossing is also used for importing fuel to Gaza. Last January, Israeli authorities closed the Nahal Oz fuel terminal in eastern Gaza. Rami Almagari, FSRN, Gaza.
India's highest court has rejected a petition for the mercy killing or euthanasia of a woman who has been in a persistent vegetative state for nearly 40 years. The Supreme Court ruled that the right to life, guaranteed in the country's constitution, does not include the right to die, but did clear the way for some forms of end-of-life practices. FSRN's Jasvinder Sehgal has the story.
Aruna Shanbag, a nurse, was brutally raped in 1973 and suffered brain damages and paralysis. She has been cared for in a Mumbai hospital ever since. A friend of Shanbag filed a petition seeking the court's permission to stop feeding her so that she could die peacefully. But the court rejected the request after impatient pleas from hospital staff. This is not for the first time that a request for mercy death has been rejected in India. But today's ruling is different because the court cleared the way for the legalization of passive euthanasia, if decided in consultation with medical staff and the High Court. Passive euthanasia involves allowing a patient to die through the withdrawal of life support systems. Parliament would have to pass legislation for it to become a law. A lawyer in the case told local media it's not clear yet if the ruling makes Shan Bagh a candidate for passive euthanasia. Jaswinder Sehgal, FSRN, India.
Immigrant advocates have criticized the recent anti-immigration shift in many state legislatures, but some are now cheering Utah legislation that is currently awaiting the signature of the governor. Under the bills passed late last Friday, law enforcement would be required to check the immigration status of people who commit felonies or some misdemeanors. But the state would also offer a guest worker program. This part of the law could run at odds with the federal government because states technically don't have the power to instate such programs. Under the legislation, the Utah governor would have 2 years to negotiate a waiver with the federal government. But many immigration activists in the state are still angry about the law enforcement aspect of the legislation. Several hundred people rallied against that provision at the Capitol on Saturday, urging the governor to veto the bill. Protesters gathered in Maine's capital today to voice opposition to the Republican governor's proposed cuts to social safety net programs. FSRN's Meredith DeFrancesco reports.
Governor Paula Page's proposed budget cuts would include a 5-year lifetime limit on receiving temporary assistance for needy families, or TANF. Despite the governor's rhetoric about protecting the disabled, research shows close to 90% of families in the state who receive TANF for more than 5 years have a family member with a disability. The budget would also restrict eligibility for Medicaid and slash subsidies for Medicare and Maine's state-subsidized health insurance program. In perhaps the most draconian measure, Governor LePage's proposal would deny Maine residents who are not U.S. citizens eligibility for Medicaid, TANF, food supplement, and supplemental security income for the first 5 years they reside in Maine. Today's rally is one of a series at the Capitol concerning the budget proposal. Meredith DeFrancesco, FSRN, Maine.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
And you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm Claire Eagle, and I'm joined in studio by Sandra and Haig, executives from the Amnesty International UBC team. So, Sandra Haig, what kind of issues are Amnesty involved in both on campus and globally right now?
Well, right now we're looking at a lot of immigration and refugee rights, like the recent influx of Libyans fleeing into Tunisia and Egypt. We've also got our conference coming up, which is looking at a lot of political rights and civil rights around the world, which is pretty exciting.
Yep. I mean, when we look at it, I mean, from a major viewpoint internationally, it's a pretty big deal. I mean, that's why Amnesty really looks on promoting human rights, because a lot of these illegal migration in particular, these migrants don't necessarily get all the rights that they should necessarily. That's what Amnesty International is trying to promote, and that's what we're trying to promote with our conference and what we do.
So you mentioned migrants, and I know that is your cause of the month right now. Are there any other areas that this issue of migrancy is a major issue in the rights of migrants, or is it primarily in Tunisia that you're focusing on it?
It's actually, like, all over the world. I mean, there was the case in January in England of the Ugandan woman that was deported even though she was a lesbian and feared being killed in Uganda. There's the internally displaced people that are that's just so sad. It's happening all the time in the Cote d'Ivoire and the DR Congo. Essentially, there's migration, illegal migration, internally displaced migration, asylum seekers all over the world at all times.
So if students are interested in this, I guess, what can they do to help out with IDPs? I know it's not something that we face a huge challenge with in Canada every day, but what can students do to become more involved?
Well, Claire, we're having our conference coming up in a couple weeks. I think it's on the... What day is it on again, Sandra?
It's on Saturday. It's from 12 till... 2 till 7 in the Irving.
In Irving, in the Lulu-Ed room, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be a great conference. I mean, it's totally free, too, so it's going to be awesome. But, I mean, if students really want to get involved, if they really want to learn more about what's going on around the world, especially with migration or illegal migration or the violation of rights regarding migration, then, I mean, it definitely would be a great opportunity for students to come out. We got speakers and food and stuff, so it's going to be great.
And I guess what kind of topics specifically are you going to focus on in this conference?
Well, we've got some professors coming in talking about the marginalization and exclusion of the poor in the democratic process in Latin America. We've got the regional coordinator from Amnesty coming in to talk about the recent protests in Cairo and Egypt and looking at freedom of expression and stuff like that. It's going to be super fascinating. Political and social rights in China. It's a real range, looking pretty much all over the world, a whole bunch of different topics. And there's free food as well, which is always interesting and fun.
That sounds great. So I guess just a couple other questions regarding Amnesty and its involvement, maybe in areas that are less known for globally. I mean, I know Tunisia obviously is very big in the headlines right now, as is Libya. But what kind of issues are you guys focusing that are maybe less known or less focused on in mainstream media?
We often do a lot of letter writing. We do letter writing just about every week, looking at various things that aren't really talked about in mainstream media. For example, a couple weeks ago, we were writing the justice minister in Bosnia because he's up for, this general is up for trial for all the genocide he was responsible for in the 90s, which isn't really talked about anymore, even though the trials are still going on. We do things like that a lot.
Yeah, there's just a lot out there that really a lot of people don't talk about. And even though we just write letters, there's only that's a huge step towards trying to bring these things to light. I mean, it would help to have. I mean, that's why we have these conferences is to actually have other additions to what we're already doing.
To bring awareness, to educate the students. That's kind of what we're all about.
And have a light for the darkness.
Wow, that sounds great. I'll be sure to check out your conference on Saturday. Thanks again for joining me, guys, today.
Thanks so much.
No problem.
All right, so once again, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard Sandra and Hank, executive members from Amnesty International UBC, talking about their upcoming conference on Saturday, as well as about various issues that Amnesty gets involved with worldwide. So we're going to take a brief break, but stay tuned. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Amnesty UBC strives to fight against the violation of human rights around the world. That's why on March 12th, Amnesty International will be hosting their annual conference, When is a Democracy Not a Democracy?, featuring speakers like Max Cameron, Margot Young, Sophia Woodman, and Don Wright. The conference will give participants the chance to enjoy speakers, workshops, and food, as well as network, learn, and be part of the fight for human rights. And here's the best bit. The conference is free and open to everyone. All you need to do is show up. That's on March 12th at 1:30 p.m. in the Irving K. Barber Learning Center's Lillooet Room. For more information, you can contact amnestyubc@gmail.com.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. We now have your weekday weather forecast brought to you by Daniel Castanova, the UBC Storm Club.
Thanks, Claire. Well, enjoy the last few hours of blue sky while you can, because we're expecting a gloomy week, as we'll be seeing a lot of clouds and rain. Daytime temperatures will remain mild throughout the week, with highs around 9 degrees and lows of around plus 5. But here's your UBC forecast. For tonight, becoming cloudy, chance of wet flurries overnight, with a low of 3 degrees. For tomorrow, periods of rain throughout the day, high of 9, low of 3 degrees. On Wednesday, rain, high of 10 degrees, low of 4. For Thursday, rain, high of 9, low of 5 degrees. For Friday, more rain with a high of 9 degrees, low of 4. On Saturday, we'll be seeing periods of rain with a high of 10 degrees, low of 5. And finally, for Sunday, expect showers with a high of 10, low of 4. Currently, it is 5 degrees and partly cloudy at UBC. The normal temperatures for this time of year are a maximum of 10 degrees and a low of 3. That's your weather this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. For News 101, I'm Daniel Castanova.
Great, thanks, Daniel. So that was your weekday weather forecast, and stay tuned because your News 101 headlines are coming right up. I'm Claire Eagle, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Ever wonder what a functioning campus and community radio station looks like? Ever stay up late at night asking yourself just how CITR stores all the CDs and records they have at their disposal?
Ever wake up early with the burning question, how does CITR manage to be the best radio station in Vancouver? Well, you're in luck, because CITR 101.9 FM is having an open house this Friday, March 4th, between 12 and 4 p.m., and you're invited. Come on down to room 233 in the sub on UBC campus for snacks, station tours, and maybe even a chance to get on air. CITR is your radio station, and we want to show you what we're all about. So come to the open house, March 4th from 12 to 4 p.m.
The Biltmore Cabaret is your home for great live music in Vancouver.
Tuesday, March 1st, check out Swedish indie poppers The Concretes playing songs from their latest LP, WYWH. Million Young and the Wit Sundays round out the bill. Doors are at 8 p.m. Friday, March 11th, don't miss the catchy stylings of Diamond Rings and P.S. I Love You as part of their co-headlining North American tour. Doors are at 8 p.m. and the show starts at 9:30. Wednesday, March 30th, New York folk rockers O'Death and Rough Trade recording artist Strange Boys will share the stage along with guests Natural Child. Doors open at 8 p.m. Wednesday, April 13th, come get your mind blown by network recording artists The Submarines, playing songs off their latest LP, Love Notes, Letter Bombs. Nick Freitas will open the show. Doors are at 8 p.m. For tickets to these shows, go to the Biltmore, Red Cat, Zulu, or online to ticketweb.ca. For information you can use, including a full schedule of upcoming shows, head to biltmorecabaret.com.
Welcome back to CITR News 101. I'm Claire Eagle, and now it's time for your News 101 headlines. In national news, on March 4th, the New Democratic Party made an announcement via Twitter that they have called on the Canadian Radio and Television Commission, or the CRTC, to expand their usage-based broad-based billing procedure, one day after citizen advocacy group Open Media requested that they do so. NDP technology critic Charlie Angus requested that the CRTC address fundamental structural problems of usage-based billings and also states that the CRTC, quote, must also examine whether vertically integrated broadcast and telecommunications companies are using usage-based billing to affect emerging broadcast competition, end quote. Open Media has also contacted the Federal Conservatives, Liberals, and the Green Party to ask the CRTC to conduct a comprehensive review of the proposal, but have not yet received a response.
In local news, local citizen watchdog group Metro Van Watch has reported that Metro Vancouver municipal councils are passing Metro Vancouver's regional growth strategy despite some opposition. Surrey, Vancouver, and Richmond voted to accept it last week, with nine municipalities reviewing the proposal in the next 3 days. The group predicts that if even one votes to not accept it, the proposal may change significantly. Existing opposition to the regional growth strategy is regarding issues such as loss of agricultural land and forests on the North Shore, as well as calls from the organization. Neighborhoods for the for a sustainable Vancouver for independent third-party reviews of the implications of the regional growth strategy and consideration of making the RGS a referendum. Says Randy Helton, coordinator of Metro Van Watch, quote, the regional growth strategy is the most important document ever produced by Metro Vancouver and will have huge implications for land use decisions over the next generation. Public awareness continues to be quite low, but councils are making a big mistake if they assume that public silence equals consent, end quote.
In regional news, Friday saw dozens of nurses gathered outside the Abbotsford Regional Hospital to protest overcrowding and the practice of offering treatment in the hospital hallways. Nurses have reported regular overcrowding, as well as placement of patients in unacceptable locations, such as in a TV room or directly beneath a security camera, both violations of patients' right to privacy. Says Deborah McPherson, president of the BC Nurses Union, rather, quote, this is simply not acceptable and it is not appropriate care, regardless of what our current health minister may say. Nurses have been raising their professional concerns here in the ER, on the medical units, and on specialty units, and they will continue to do so with our support until the quality of care issues are resolved, end quote.
In local news, conflict has arisen regarding comments made by Reverend Rick Matthews of the iconic First United Church in the Vancouver downtown east side. When asked about sexual assault at the First United shelter, Matthews was quoted in the province as saying, quote, some women put themselves at risk because of the way they dress or undress or move around the building. They draw attention to themselves, end quote. A coalition of women and residents of the DTES have expressed anger towards these comments. Elaine DeRocher, a DTES resident and member of the DTES Power of Women group, says, quote, "Those who experience sexual assault are not the ones at fault. Instead of taking sexual assaults against women seriously, a comment like Matthew's stigmatizes women and sends an unacceptable message that they are to blame for assaults committed against them," end quote. The Downtown Eastside Women's Center is currently calling for a 24-hour drop in space and shelter for women in the area. In response to the anger caused by his comments, the First United Church stated in a press release that they do not, quote, "under any circumstances, blame the victims and see the safety of the women who come here for shelter as being of paramount importance," end quote. To prevent further incidents, First United has implemented increased staffing in sleeping areas, posted no tolerance of sexual assault signs, and has invited the Coalition of Women and women's organizations to discuss future initiatives together.
In campus news, a University of British Columbia study released on March 1st has found that efforts to switch vehicles to clean fuel may not improve harmful emissions and may in fact negatively impact the climate. The study examined more than 5,000 vehicles in New Delhi, India, which made the effort in 2003 to convert 90,000 buses, taxis, and auto rickshaws to compressed natural gas, or CNG, which is commonly seen as a clean fuel. However, the majority of these engines were powered by two-stroke engines, the most common type of engine used in small Asian public vehicles, and these cause the CNG used to only minorly reduce the emissions that cause air pollution. At the same time, the emissions that negatively impact climate change were increased. The study recommends that four-stroke engines be used instead of two-stroke engines to ensure that the CNG is burned properly and to reduce the risk of methane emissions, and also advises policymakers to consider smaller vehicles, such as rickshaws, when implementing emissions reduction programs. Says UBC postdoctoral fellow Connor Reynolds, lead author of the study, quote, "If policymakers have information about emissions and their potential impacts, they can make better decisions to serve both the public and the environment," end quote.
Last Wednesday, the BC Cancer Agency announced its third breakthrough discovery in just over a year. The discovery, published in the international journal Nature, was found by the Center for Lymphoid Cancer, headed by principal investigator Dr. Randy Gascoigne. They discovered the single cancer gene responsible for 15% of Hodgkin lymphoma cases, a frequent type of cancer that occurs in white blood cells, as well as for 40% of another type of lymphoma. From this study, researchers learned how the cancer can remain undetected by a patient's immune system and causes the body's protective white cells to lose their ability to detect cancer cells. Says the study's lead author, Dr. Christian Steidel, quote, "It's always been puzzling how cancer cells are able to evade the immune system and continue to grow. This study gives us unique insight into how they rearrange their chromosomes to do so," end quote. Also in health updates, a reminder that from our health correspondent Sharon Hundle, tomorrow, Tuesday and Wednesday, is the Engineering Wellness Expo in the Fred Kaiser Atrium from 12 to 2 p.m. Sharon will be back next week with coverage of the event.
So we're going to take a quick break now, but stay with us. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Are you interested in radio, but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit citr.ca for more information.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Gordon Lee. It's now time for your arts report with Adam Yanush.
The Canadian Red Cross and the Vancouver Public Library present an interactive evening that explores the unique experiences of refugee students and some of the myths surrounding refugees today. It's called A Story to Tell and a Place to Tell It. And along with several speakers, the night will showcase artwork done by young people who arrived in Canada as refugees. By artwork, I mean comics created entirely by the teenagers exploring their experiences as refugees. As you'll hear from as you'll hear from Alejandra Lopez, this who is one of the art project's creators, it was as much about the experience of reflecting on their traumatic experiences and the celebration of their individuality as much as it was about showing off the final product. Here's Alejandra talking about where the idea of healing and expression through comics came from.
Well, it was hosted by a Francophone community center called La Boussole that gives services to Francophone speakers to find employment and find housing and different things. Mm-hmm. But it was a group of people. Among them was Pascal Ignesquera, which is also came to Canada as a refugee from Burundi. And she was an employee at La Boussole and a professor from UBC called Pilar Riaño, among other people, that they experienced through their work that there was a gap of services and spaces for youth, for refugee youth. And it's already difficult for teenagers, wherever they are, to adapt and to feel comfortable with who they are. Mm-hmm. And refugee and immigrant youth face those challenges, plus coming to a completely different cultural setting, mm-hmm. Leaving everything away, maybe family members,
right.
The weather, their food, and they are not able to speak the language. Mm-hmm. They go to school and they just feel different.
So it's like, you know, teenagers have enough troubles as it is. In a way, these kids are sort of double teenagers or have double adolescence.
I agree. And they probably are like really mature because of the different things that they faced.
Right. It makes them grow up faster.
Exactly. Because of the things, the reasons of why they had to leave. Flee their countries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what exactly happens? Because like you say, there was something missing. There was something missing for these kids to help them adapt. And so this idea comes along to use comics. What happens? What is it in the process? And what is the outcome? What is it that these kids do in these comics that helps them adapt?
It's we chose a comic as a media to address isolation, language barriers, to build confidence and build leadership skills, because we thought that we aimed to support youth that were in the process of adapting and that they didn't speak the language, but there was this need for them to tell their stories of their journey, mm-hmm. to feel confident with like the cultural difference that they brought and feel proud of them as well, mm-hmm. and be able to integrate instead of assimilate to this place. So I thought like illustration is like a universal language. Mm-hmm. You don't necessarily have to communicate with words. Mm-hmm. So it was and storytelling as well, because it's about both, like using art, mm-hmm. and using storytelling techniques to mm-hmm. be able to heal and feel more empowered.
And it was the process as well that was a big part of it. It wasn't necessarily the outcome of, you know, get this comic finished. It was the making of it that was therapeutic, would you say?
Exactly. It was a hard balance because we paired them with comic book artists that they had this artistic awareness and they were really focusing on the outcome and producing the comic,
right.
and the kids learning how to do very good comics. But for us, the organizers, was also about how through the process they built friendships, they mm-hmm. they reflect on their identity, mm-hmm. And feel that they belong. Even being different, actually, the difference would be so enriching for their communities and feel like that their self-esteem was strong, mm-hmm. no matter that they have accents or that they look different, because it's
so
exciting.
That their differences and all the things that make them unique culturally is something to be celebrated. Yeah.
To be celebrated, exactly.
Not to be forgotten or hidden.
Yeah, so the process was the for me was the main focus, because mm-hmm. it was about like how they felt and the transformation that they go through while telling their story and drawing.
Okay, now we're quickly running out of time, but I do want to ask you, what will people see at A Story to Tell, especially with these comics? Will people get to see them?
Yeah, they were going to be exhibiting at the room where the symposium will take place, which is going to be very interesting. There's going to be lots of activities and speakers, but the comics are going to be, I'm going to be handing out comics, and the exhibition, the original ones, are going to be laid out across the room so that people can see and learn mm-hmm. from these youth.
Great. And can you quickly speak to what else is happening?
Yeah. There's going to be a refugee youth from that is studying at UBC that came through the program, through the WASC program, the World University Service Canada, sponsored by the government. And she's going to tell her story. And there's going to be an activity that will be interacting with the audience to be more aware about what refugees go through. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be other organizations that give services to refugees. Excellent. Here in Vancouver.
Great. Well, this sounds like a great journey and an interesting product. So thanks so much for telling us about it today.
Thank you for having me.
And that's Alejandra Lopez talking about A Story to Tell and A Place to Tell It, which is coming March 7th to the Vancouver Public Library. That's the big central library, the Alice McKay Room, to be specific. Admission is free, but seating is limited, so get there early.
Thanks, Adam. Last week marked the 100th anniversary of BC Parks. We talked to Gwen Barley of the Wilderness Committee to find out more.
Last Tuesday marked the 100-year anniversary of BC Parks, an important part of the province's acclaimed natural beauty. However, in recent years, the protected areas have seen a significant drop in funding and staffing, and as a result, a decline in tourism as well. Today, I spoke with Gwen Barley, Policy Director at the Wilderness Committee, a nonprofit wilderness protection group based here in Vancouver. I know the Auditor General report came out recently.
Yeah.
And what did that have to say about the state of BC's parks?
Well, it wasn't very good. It was quite critical, and it came out, I think, in September of 2010. And what it showed in a nutshell was the government wasn't doing a good enough job of protecting the ecological integrity of our provincial parks. And so the Auditor General recommended a series of steps that included things like every park, Class A park, is supposed to have a master plan, and that tells you how the park is supposed to be managed. And we find out that only 24% of parks in BC, Class A parks in BC, have master plans. And so that's something that needs to be taken care of. There's certain ecological systems that aren't in our protected area system, and the government needs to report back to the public on how whether they're meeting their stated goal of protecting ecological integrity within our 1,000 parks and protected areas in BC. And so that was confirmation of what many environmental groups have been saying over the last 10 years, is BC parks are between a rock and a hard place. That, and to give one example, we just have 10 full-time permanent park rangers for almost, over 13 million hectares. And we have a few more rangers that are hired in the summer, but it's far, far, far below other jurisdictions. The government, the BC government, when they came in 2001, they removed, they took out government-funded interpretive programs. So just BC and Mississippi are the only jurisdictions in North America that have no government-funded interpretive programs. We also had initiatives such as the government wanting to have resorts by private companies established within parks. They put in parking meters in 43 popular parks and drove away millions and millions of visitors. The park budget is 25% below it, below where it was in 2001. For park staffing levels outside of rangers, we're half of where we were in 1996 when the park system was half the size it is today. And so everywhere you look, that parks need a little bit of TLC. And so what we're calling on, and it's not just the Wilderness Committee, it's other environmental groups, we're calling on the BC government, and this year actually is the 100-year anniversary of our park system, and we're calling on the BC government to take meaningful steps and so implement the Auditor General's recommendations to better protect our park system, to increase the BC Parks operational budget, that it's around $29 million, and it needs to be at least $60 million, that we need to remove parking meters out of our parks and welcome people back into our protected area system. We need to have a stronger legislation to protect the ecological integrity of our park system. And those are some of the steps, and obviously reinstating government-funded interpretive programs. And those are just some of the steps that we need to see to have action to better protect our park system.
So it sounds like there are a lot of things that are wrong, and I'm just wondering, do you think that these issues with underfunding and so on that have that the parks are suffering, do you think that affects the parks more in an ecological sense or more in the sense that individuals who want to go visit them can't really enjoy them the way they should?
I think it's both. I think it's an ecological sense. And when you don't have management plans in place, you don't have a straightforward plan for how to best protect a certain park, whether it's Garibaldi Park, whether it's Golden Ears, whether it's Mount Robson. Are you dealing effectively with invasive species? Are you making sure that you don't have ATVs going into, you know, sensitive alpine meadows? But I also think it impacts the ability of British Columbians to come in and enjoy our park system. And you see that in the numbers, that in 1999, we had about 25 million visitors within our provincial park system. That number dropped to just a couple of years ago to about 17 million visitors, and that's a drop of about 25 to 30%.
Oh, wow.
And you don't see that in other jurisdictions. You don't see that in federal parks in B.C., you don't see that in Alberta. You don't see that in Washington State. You know, you don't see it in Saskatchewan. And so you have basic things that BC Parks isn't even, and park rangers don't have the ability to be able to promote our park system the way it should be. And you've seen fewer and fewer people coming into parks because of that. And it's a shame because we know kids nowadays that oftentimes, you know, more so probably than when I was growing up, they're in front of their computers more. They're playing video games more. And so there's this nature deficit that's being sort of afflicting, you know, kids growing up today. And so that's one of the important reasons why we need to make our parks accessible to people. We need to invite people back into our park system. But we also need to make sure that our park system is protected for future generations.
And I guess it also must be impacting BC's image overall, because BC is known as like a land of natural beauty.
Absolutely.
And if they can't be enjoyed that way, then...
Well, no, it kind of makes me laugh, because you saw this, of course, especially in the 2010 Winter Olympics.
Right.
That a lot of the advertising was about beautiful BC, and it really showcased our park system in most of the advertising that you saw. And it's sort of ironic that we know that our parks and protected area system is special, that it contributes to a high quality of life in BC, but the government talks the talk, but they don't walk the walk. And what I find kind of awful is, you know, so you have the operational budget for BC Parks, and it's about $29 million, and yet the operational budget for Public Affairs Bureau, and that's the government's spin doctors, is $26 million. And so it's kind of ironic that here BC Parks is being starved of funding and staffing, and the Auditor General says that the government's not doing enough to protect the ecological integrity of our parks, and yet the government can't find the wherewithal to make a smart investment within our park system. This government has given hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies to the oil and gas sector, and we'd like to see some of that money actually going back into our protected area system.
Do you hope that with a new premier anything might change, or do you think
I hope so. I mean, Premier Designate Clark has said that things are going to be different, and I hope that applies to this government's approach to environmental protection in the province, and specifically I hope it applies to this government's management of parks, because it's been a decade of decay for BC's park system under this current provincial government.
So I guess lastly, what is there that ordinary citizens can do to help out? Is there anything that we really can do?
Well, I think one of the things you can do is you know, let your friends know, let your neighbors know, let your coworkers know, and this makes a big, big difference. Write in a letter to your member of the Legislative Assembly. Send a letter to the new Premier Designate, Christy Clark. We have at the Wilderness Committee, at wildernesscommittee.org, we have letter-writing tools that people can use to, you know, to ask decision-makers to better protect our park system. And so those are some of the things that people can, you know, actions that people can take, and it's estimated for every letter that a person writes that it represents 500 people who feel the same way.
Uh-huh.
So taking half an hour or an hour out of everybody's very, very busy life to write a letter really can make a difference, and especially now because there's a media spotlight on our protected area system, because it is, you know, Tuesday was actually the 100-year anniversary, and it's all started with Strathcona Park on Vancouver Island. And now today we have, you know, as I mentioned, over 1,000 parks and protected areas. So I'd really encourage people to get in touch with local decision makers and let them know how they feel about having adequate funding and protection for our park system. And also taking the opportunity to write in letters to the editor or phone in to talk shows. That all those things can make a difference, and we can make sure that our our BC parks are properly funded and protected if we do that.
All right. Well, great. Thanks, Gwen. It's been great talking to you today.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Thanks again.
No. And that's our program for March 4th, 2011. Don't forget to vote in the current AMS referendum. Voting can be done by accessing your student service center online and then going to WebVote, which is listed right underneath grades and records. The referendum is split into five separate votes on different issues such as bylaws, their fee restructuring, which is the key part, as well as the UPass. So make sure you go online and cast your ballot today. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts, and if you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. We are currently looking for intrepid reporters to join our news team, so please contact us if you're interested. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, join us Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle. It's been a pleasure being here today.
And I'm Gordon Lee. This show was produced by Iqbal Ahmed. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for our sore throats and clapping hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Protein and 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 protein Cool.